Surgical Neurology International, and SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, in association with the Sub-Saharan African Neurosurgeons, are pleased to sponsor the Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds, held on the first Sunday of each month. This third Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds is entitled Global Solutions to Clinical Challenges in Neurosurgery. There are discussions from Africa, Argentina, France, Persia, and the USA. Moderators are Estrada Bernard and James Hausman. This speaker will present a comprehensive review of the diagnosis and management of tuberculoma of the brain, on his experience in Kenya. Lecture and discussion is 40 minutes. It will be given by Professor Nim J.M. Mugwambi, with multiple degrees from UK medical schools and universities. He's a professor of surgery at the School of Medicine in Kenyatta University in Nairobi, Kenya. His email contact is listed. He's formerly head of neurosurgery and professor of surgery at the University of Nairobi in Kenyatta National Hospital campus and research registrar of the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery at Queen Square in London, England.
So the discussion will actually be on tuberculomas and not hydatids. It was a big it's a very long topic, and it will take a bit of time. And what I'm going to present is a case we managed with my team, and the team which we managed with is Dr. Kanja. Dr. Kanja was the primary surgeon. Dr. Njiro was the assistant surgeon. Dr. Odhiambo was the radiologist who assisted us in making the diagnosis. And Dr. Okemwa was the pathologist who did the pathological diagnosis for us. Now we present a case of tuberculoma of the brain managed in Nairobi, Kenya. We review the role of surgery in the management of brain tuberculomas as seen in low and middle income countries. We review the pattern of brain tuberculomas in Kenya, and maybe we'll touch a bit on the rest of the world. Now, this is the case summary. It's a 54-year-old female. She's diabetic, which may have had a role to play in the diagnosis. She's a widow, para 5, para 0. She presented with history of headache and grand mal fits for a period of 9 months. She had been put on anticonvulsants. Neurological examination, she was stable. GCS was 15 over 15. And the only thing which we could detect was fundoscopy showed papillary edema. There were no lateralizing signs. Our clinical impression then was a space-occupying lesion. She was referred. She had been referred to us. Now, at the area where she had been referred, a CT scan had been done. And the CT scan was, as happens in many areas where we come from on this part of my country, the CT scan sometimes is done without contrast. And sometimes this is for financial reasons, because if it's done with contrast, then you're charged a bit higher. But sometimes when they do the CT scan, if they see something and they feel that this patient needs a referral, then they'll do a CT scan and they'll refer. And then the neurosurgeons or the managing physicians will decide what furthermore investigations need to be done. So this was the CT scan which was done at the referral hospital, which showed these parenchymal hypodensities without calcifications or hemorrhage, probably bilateral frontal lobe vasogenic edema. The ventricles in these CT scans were normal. Midbrain and brainstems also were normal. The differentials then were that this could have been high-grade glioma or probably an infective process or probably a metastatic lesion. So then she was referred to our unit. And when she came to our unit, then we proceeded to perform an MRI. And these are the images which we did on the MRI. You can see here I've show you the images on the left-hand side. is T1 weighted image, and then the right-hand side you have T2 T1 weighted image with contrast. So in the T1 weighted image, you have a large left frontal convexity mixed signal lesion is seen. It is largely hypointense on T1 weighted. Pressure effects on the ipsilateral frontal horn, you can observe that, and there is midline shift on the to the right, and that will bring a point as to how why we made a decision to go ahead and do surgery. Now, when we give contrast, then what was obvious was the crescentic left crescentic shaped convexity lesion involving the dura with ring enhancement. And very, very large surrounding vasogenic edema. And of course, enhancement, you can see the dural enhancements, which you see on that side. And the other image, which here with MRI, we did in the T2 weighted and flare, there's hypointense on T2 weighted and flare with extensive vasogenic edema. And in the diffuse weighted imaging with gradient, there was no restriction on diffuse weighted imaging and no blooming on gradient. So we, and then these are just the images which I have already explained to you. You can see the lesion, the main lesion is the one at the extreme periphery, which if you look at these images, the extreme periphery, that's where the lesion is, and then what you see on the other sides are the associated vasogenic edema. Again, that's just to re-emphasize those points. So we proceeded because of this mass effect, gross mass effect. We proceeded to subject. We at the time of going to surgery, tuberculoma was really not very much in our mind, but it was one of the differentials. But we thought that probably this may be a metastatic lesion or a high-grade glioma. Now, this is just a summary of the MRI and CT findings, which I've already explained, and the conclusion was a ring-enhancing crescentic mass in the left frontal convexity with extensive perilesional edema and mass effect, and the differentials, which were discussed with the radiologists, our neuroradiologists, whether this could be an infective process, also it could be cerebral metastasis or a high-grade glioma. So this is the approach which we used. And the patient was taken to theater and surgery was done the conventional way. Now, this is the patient positioned for surgery on the top left-hand side. On the left-hand side bottom, this is the patient after the surgery. The bone flap has already been replaced. Now, on the middle slide is what was seen. When we entered, what was found was that there was a lesion which was extraaxial. It was not penetrating into the brain, but it was compressing the brain, and very, very much attached to the dura. And if you look at this slide on the right-hand side, that is the dura with the lesion there attached to, and we actually could scrape it. And then on the left-hand side, that is the lesion now, which was nitty-gritty and could be dissected out, but not invading the brain at all. And there was some casseating material which was encountered during the surgery. So in fact, during the surgery, the impression was that this was an infective process, and because we do see these tuberculomas in our area, this was most likely tuberculoma. That was our clinical impression. And this is a patient that is just immediately after surgery, and she went home 6 days following surgery, and we started her on anti-TB therapy empirically while we waited for the pathologist to give us their report. Now, the pathologist dealt with this. I've discussed this with them, and unfortunately, they could not be with us today. But as you can look at these slides, the top slide, you see the granulomas consisting of lymphocytes, fibrosis, epithelial cells, Langerhans multinucleated germ cells. And on the lower side, again, you see the multinucleated germ cells of the necklaced type. And in this is just a high magnification, which is showing those the granuloma formation on that slide. We did a Zeilen stain, Zeilenissen stain, which was positive for acid alcohol fast bacilli. So after this, and these are the tests which we commonly do in our setup We don't do the appointment with PCR. We don't do that too. It's not yet affordable to our patients. It's quite expensive. So the diagnosis then was a brain tracheoma, and a patient was put on anti-TB therapy in the conventional way. Once we make this diagnosis as surgeons in our referral hospitals, then we have a team which now takes over and gives the patient further management for TB. So it's not us who do it, but we have to be conversant with what usually needs to be done. And because we were not sure that this was trachoma, this patient before surgery, this patient was not put on anti-TB therapy before surgery. This was started after surgery. If there are any questions, I could take the questions before we go to the discussion part.
Did you ever have an explanation for the decreased density in both frontal lobes, or you think it was edema spreading to both sides?
Now, we think it was edema spreading to both sides. That was our impression. And we think that this was a false, because there was a subfalcine herniation. So we think that the subfalcine herniation was the one which had made those features on the other side.
And then when you removed the tuberculoma, what was your observation? How adherent was it to the pia? And were you able
Very,
to?
very.
Okay.
It was it was not very adherent to the pia, but very adherent to the dura, attached completely to the dura. And we had, in fact, we came out with the dura, and we had to put a patch, dural patch, to cover the gap.
Well, I wondered if you might have had thickening of the pia to the extent that you were able to separate it without disrupting the pia. I'm just curious about that. I'm thinking in terms of what we might see with a meningioma if you still have preservation of the arachnoid membrane. But were you able to separate it from the pial surface without disruption because it wasn't so adherent to the pia itself? I know you said it was very adherent to the dura.
Yes, and I think let me just confess that because I was not the primary surgeon, then I may not be able to answer. I get your
Oh,
point,
okay.
but I may not be able to answer that confidently.
Okay,
But I
thank
get
you.
your point.
Dr. Strada, can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, please, please, Ali.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, I don't know this routine in your country. Do you do a skin test, PPD skin test over there routinely? The other question is that do they use BCG as a preventive on all the people? Because in some countries they give BCG vaccine to increase the immunity of the people. They do it in Iran, they do it in most of the country, Mexico, everywhere, except US, that they don't give that BCG vaccine. So is there anything that you do over there to prevent the tuberculosis? And also, other question is that when you separated from the dura, the tuberculoma, did you have to replace the dura with another artificial one, or just you put it back the same thing it is?
Okay, fine. Let me use of BCG is routine in my country. So we have very good immunization programs.
Excellent.
And what I have found over the years as we continue the discussion is that in spite of the use of the BCG, we still get patients who get TB. And I've never been able to explain this. Now, then the other one is the skin test. We do the skin test, but usually we would do the skin test when tuberculin skin tests when we are very much in doubt. And but in a case like this one where we have made a decision because of the mass effect to go ahead and do the surgery, we may not do a tuberculin skin test. But then if, for example, some of the cases where there's no much mass effect and we are considering making a diagnosis and putting the patient on medical management without doing surgery, we may do tuberculin skin test and then combine it with the other tests like ESR and blood works, and if possible PCR, and then if we are very positive, then set the patient on anti-TB therapy. And we commonly also do that, especially in children who we encounter with CNS tuberculosis, or small and deep-seated, where we feel that we can't even do a biopsy, and we have to empirically start the patient on treatment for TB. And sometimes those patients do improve.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Well,
Okay.
Nimrod, a point about the BCG. So administration, if everybody's given the BCG, that's going to give you a false positive on the PPD test, right?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. In fact, you'd be very surprised. Sometimes we do see this energy where patients have had BCG, and we do the skin test, and still it's negative. But I must say that I can't confidently answer that question because I'm a surgeon, and I think the physicians or the pediatricians would be the ones who can give you a more confident answer on that matter.
Okay. Ali had his hands raised.
Yes,
Ali?
Doctor. Yeah, we have a lot of patients from Mexico because they all had BCG over there routinely. And that is true. Those who have BCG, even myself who had the BCG, I am TB positive on the skin test. And the routinely, what the health department asks us, we do just the chest X-ray just to show that there is no lesion and no need for the INH therapy or start any tuberculosis therapy. And that is very true. There is a new blood test has come that they do it only in the hospitals and county when we have a doubt about the tuberculosis, which is very serious, sensitive, but still there are false negative cases. We had one case at UCLA that they missed it. And that is very true. And there are cases of refractory epilepsy, tuberculosis, sorry. And we had few cases coming from other countries to US, and they were not reactive to any anti-TB therapy, and they had to be put on the quarantine. That is very true. There are refractory cases, and it's a major issue even in the US with the immigrant coming from certain country, which is endemic over there. Thank you very much, Doctor, for your explanation.
Thank you. So if I could continue, let me just review this subject, which we thought that we have done away with it, but nowadays it seems to be coming back. TB remains a major global problem in public health issue of considerable magnitude. In recent times, there's been resurgence of TB, both in developing and developed countries. Several risk factors have been observed for this serious phenomenon. The incidence, which we, as you see there in US, is very, very low, 9 cases per 100,000. In developing countries like ours, it's 110, 165 per 100,000. In my country, it's about almost 300 per 100,000, 300 per 100,000. So it's quite a big problem. Now, we did a review, and this is quite some time ago, because we see a lot of these tuberculomas, and we did a review of the cases which we had managed. And I know this is a bit of an old paper, but I like quoting it because what we found is basically what we are seeing now. Patients present with headache and seizures, and in many of our situations, some of the patients had also systemic tuberculosis, as well as tuberculoma. Now, the mortality was quite high in our patients because of the fact that they tended to come late. So quite a number of the patients, we lost quite a number of patients in those early years. 30% made a full recovery. And this is a big problem which we get in our country, because as much as if they come early, like this lady came early, then we can do the surgery and we get good results. But if they come later, and this, as you see from the classification or the clinical classification of the disease, and let's say they are already GCS is low, then many of them may not do so well. Now, these are, we say, we still say this a disease of low socioeconomic status, and we see most of the patients we see are young population. The patients who I saw in my study, most of them were below the age of 30 years. This lady was in her 50s, but remember she was diabetic, and I think probably diabetes may have played a role in the disease. HIV has increased the pool of patients with TB. Kenya is considered a high burden nation due to the high prevalence of TB, where we are about 300 per 100,000 cases. Now, this is a big problem we face when even us working in the wards. And when we work in the wards, we have to take precautions. And I've, during my years at Kenyatta National Hospital, I had two of my residents who developed tuberculosis while they were working at Kenyatta National Hospital. So we have usually to take those precautions, wear masks and take all the precautions as you work in the hospital, because it's quite easy to get to pick TB while you're working in our situations. Now, this is a map which is just showing you the prevalence of this condition. And Dr. Said has said, you know, they are seeing most the more cases now because of the migrant populations who are coming with these indices from the areas where it's endemic. But in our situations where it is endemic, these are cases we see quite regularly, and we have to put them on the high list whenever we see patients presenting that way. And nowadays, not all the cases do we operate with, because we're able sometimes to come up with a diagnosis that this could be TB, and we have to make a decision as to whether the patient needs surgery or not. This is just showing the predisposing factors. As you can see, the host plays a role. For example, if he's immunosuppressed, the environment plays a role, and the pathogen also plays a role. And if all these interact, then the condition becomes quite heavy. Predisposing factors, I've mentioned them there. Now, tuberculosis involvement of the central nervous system is an important serious type of extrapyramidal involvement. It has been estimated that approximately 10% of all patients with TB have CNS involvement. The incidence of CNS TB is directly proportional to prevalence of tuberculosis infection in the general population, and that's why we get it quite often in the developing countries, and it tends to occur in the younger age group and especially in childhood. And most of the organisms, as you all are aware, is Mycobacterium tuberculosis. But we need to bear in mind that in HIV infected patients, then there are other types of organisms apart from Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which I will also mention. The pathophysiology, we all know about the rich focus, and sometimes the rich focus and its location may not spread. The lesion may just remain there quiescent. But then after some time, let's say the patient is immunosuppressed or gets into some situation where then the lesion now flares up, then now it may spread. And once it's spread, of course, it can spread to whichever areas. Okay, that, as I said, some of these things, I don't want to dwell them on them very much, because most of you are quite conversant with them, and this is just to sort of like discuss this case as to what is the way forward, or what do we do with these cases of TB. Now, in this slide, we're sharing to you the TB and where we play a role as neurosurgeons in my country in managing this patient. We do see quite a lot of tuberculosis meningitis, and sometimes we are called upon to manage a patient who has developed hydrocephalus because of tuberculosis meningitis. And the other aspects are managed by the neurologists, and we are not called upon to go into it. So tuberculosis hydrocephalus as a result of tuberculosis meningitis, we'll go through it as in this discussion as to what exactly should we do. Should we put a shunt? Should we keep on draining until the hydrocephalus settles down? And what are the risks of inserting a VP shunt in a patient who has got tuberculosis meningitis, which is active? And then, of course, now parenchymeningitis, where now you have the parenchymal tuberculomas, as I've said. It's not all cases of parenchymal tuberculomas which need surgery. And in many situations, especially in us in developing countries, we have to make a decision as to whether the patient needs surgery. What I have found over time is if there's mass effect and the lesion is huge, big, then we need to do surgery. And the lesion which we removed from this patient was amongst the small ones. In fact, I would probably call it the one, the TB, which usually goes in just to the dura and within the near the calvarium. And but usually the ones we see, the tuberculomas we see, are quite large, and there's no way they can be they can be resolved just with the anti-TB therapy. So this one, the one we did to in this case, the one I've presented, was very, very much like tuberculoma and plaque. Again, this for the diagnostic purposes, then one needs to go ahead and do surgery. That CNS spinal TB, we see quite a lot of it in my country, but in my country, spinal TB, as neurosurgeons, it's usually managed by the orthopedic surgeons, and we rarely do surgery unless we get tuberculomas of the spinal of the spine itself, and we do see that not so often, but we do see that, and then the situations then we are called upon to do surgery for that. Intracranial tuberculomas are firm, avascular, spherical, granulomatous masses measuring about 2-8 centimeters. They are well limited from surrounding brain tissue, which is compressed around the lesion and shows edema and gliosis. The inside of these masses may contain necrotic areas composed of caseous material, occasionally thick and purulent, which tubercle bacilli can be demonstrated. Intracranial tuberculomas can occur at any age. In developing countries, young adults and children are predominantly affected, while in developed countries, they are more common in the older patients. The symptoms will be related to their location. It could be low-grade fever, headache, vomiting, seizures, and focal neurological deficits and papillary edema. Infratentorial tuberculomas are more common in children and may present with brainstem syndromes. Cerebellum manifestation as multiple cranial nerve pulses. We do see quite a lot of brainstem tuberculomas, and sometimes we have to distinguish these brainstem tuberculomas from brainstem tumors. And nowadays with MRIs, it helps us a lot. But the judgment becomes very, very difficult because I've seen quite a number of cases of pontine tuberculomas, and which once you put the patient on anti-TB therapy, they do very well, and then you feel happy that this patient has survived and it's not a malignancy. And again, this is just empirical management where you are just making a decision, and patients end up doing well. But whichever way, even if it was a pontine glioma, you know, we rarely biopsy pontine gliomas in our setup here. Symptoms, I've already gone through the symptoms. Grading, there are two types of grading. There's the MRC grading, the velar grading, and the grading may have a good bearing on what are the results you get when you manage these patients. As you can see, our patient was stage one. She was fully conscious. She was no paresis. But you can sometimes find that you're getting patients who have got reduced level of consciousness, or they're deeply comatose as per the MRC classification. And I think many of the patients, especially the ones who did badly in the study, which we did in our review almost 30 or 40 years ago, were the ones who did well were in stage one, and the ones who didn't do so well were in stage two, and the ones who died were probably in stage three. Now we have to remember that the mortality in these patients can be high when the patients present late. Now this is the Velore grading, and on the right-hand side, this is the modified one, which is it can help you, especially if you want to do a study on the cases, because then you will get results which can be reproduced, or they can be explained. For example, if grade one, the G patients is GCS15, no neurological deficits, like our patient, for example. And then G grade two, GCS15 with neurological deficits. And then grade three, now the patient is going to GCS9 to 14. And grade four, the patient is now really a moribund patient, where you may not get much good outcome after the management. Now, imaging studies, we have gone through that, and I have taken you through the images which we did. And the imaging is very, very important because in many cases, you can be able, if you have got good images, to even decide that this could be tuberculoma and you know, the one which doesn't need surgery, and then continue to go ahead and manage it. And sometimes in my country, cysticercosis is not a problem. But in some countries where cysticercosis is a problem, then you have to bear that in mind when you see these granulomas that they could probably be due to cysticercosis. So especially in India, and I think my colleague in DRC who had just had a presentation like that last time. Now, these are images we are sharing, and really, I know these images are just like what you manage. Now, the role of chest X-ray is very important because many patients, like in our study, I think about almost 30 or 40% of the patients had systemic TB. So the chest X-ray, you must do a chest X-ray in these patients to find out if there's active TB. I think our patient may have had a chest X-ray, although I didn't present it in this study. And this is just a chest X-ray which shows a patient who had miliary TB. And of course, a patient who has miliary TB, then is more very likely to spread that miliary TB to other areas. That's just a summary of what are the findings which you will notice when you do the images. Now, we have also to bear in mind that the TB of the parenchyma may also be of the type of brain abscess, tuberculous brain abscess. Now, these are two different type of conditions. Tuberculoma presents with granulomas, while tuberculous abscess actually presents just like the usual brain abscess. In developing countries, tuberculous abscess have been reported about 4 to 7, about less than 8% in patients with CNS TB. And many times in my experience, it's almost impossible to say whether this is a tuberculous abscess, because a CT scan will just present like an abscess, and it's only when you do the surgery that you realize that this could be a tuberculous abscess. Now, this, of course, this is an image for characteristic features of a tubercular abscess, and as I said, it's almost impossible, you know, from the images to know that this could be a tubercular abscess, and you just have to approach it as an abscess, and then it turns out that this could be a tubercular abscess. Now, in our country, in my area where we're working, because we see a lot of TB, then always we have to bear in mind that this could be tubercular abscess. And then, of course, in the MRI, when nowadays it has helped a lot because you can do MRI spectroscopy, which can help you now pinpoint more that this could be infective lesion rather than a malignant lesion. And it helps a lot in decision making. Now, usually these are solitary, they're large, and the treatment is the same. We have to do surgery, drain them. And management is just the way we manage the usual brain abscesses. But I mentioned this because so that you can be aware of it. It's not as common as tuberculoma in our country, but we do see it, and we have to bear that in mind. And this is where we're sharing features of tuberculoma and features of a tubercular abscess. Macroscopic, you can see a thick wall in a tuberculoma, in a tubercular abscess, it's a thin wall, and usually with a purulent center. And then microscopic, usually you may not see much, or even with a culture from the pus which you remove from a tubercular abscess, while from a tuberculoma, you most times you can be able to make a good histopathological diagnosis. So tubercular abscess, because as I say, you can see it's only about 4 to 8% of the cases of CNS involvement. They're not so common, and I haven't managed to write, although I wrote a paper on brain abscesses. The brain abscesses which you did were pyogenic, and none of those cases were tuberculous. Now, this is a situation of tuberculoma en plaques, which is rare and seen as dural based. And sometimes I'm wondering whether this patient, why he presented was not tuberculoma and plaque. Mass forming localized meningeal processes resembling an plaque meningioma or meningeal metastasis. It's commonly in the frontal or parietal lobes, and it may be intermesospheric. And of course, the treatment is the same. You just have to, if there's mass effect, you have to do surgery and remove them. Now, the HIV is still a problem in our country. And the only advantage we have is that there are good drugs now, the availability of very good drugs, so that the patients can be able to lead almost normal lives, even if they're diagnosed to be HIV positive. But it's still a big problem in my country, and it's one of the big challenges which we face. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why the TB is re-emerging, because the fact that the patients are immunosuppressed, then it has resulted in TB again becoming a big, big, major problem. Now, the patients who are HIV positive, the type of tuberculosis they get is a bit different, because they get what we call Mycobacterium avium complex, MSC, and where there's either Mycobacterium avia or Mycobacterium intracellulare. So one has to bear that in mind when you diagnose these patients, and especially if sometimes maybe they may get TB resistant. And we do see cases of TB resistant, and it's very, very unfortunate, because you find in such situations, there's very little you can do, and many of those patients usually succumb to the illness. But we have to bear in mind the CNS involvement, which may occur in about 20% of patients with AIDS. Laboratory diagnosis, I've gone through it. What I would like here to mention is we just talked about intradermal tuberculin skin test is helpful when it is positive, but it can be negative. And in many of our situations, it is sometimes negative. Now, remember, when it is positive, then you have to learn how to interpret it. So you have to interpret it so that it has to, because in many situations in our country, it will be positive because patients have got BCGs. But if it is hyper-positive, usually I think it's a 10 millimeters, then we say that it is positive. Then the question now, if it is negative, what do you do? Therefore, in many situations, you find it may not add much value to your management of that patient. And then, of course, you have to bear in mind, as I've said, talked about ESR, the WBC total and differentials. All this come into mind when you're considering managing the patient conservatively without doing surgery, which many situations where there's no mass effect and we have to make a decision whether to start the patient on anti-TB therapy or not, then we rely on this diagnosis. But again, as I may say, in my setup, because it's a referral, most times we're working in a referral hospital, these are not decisions which we make. So these are decisions which are made by the senior physicians who manage these conditions, and they're the ones who will come and do all those tests and make the decisions. Now, the PCR test in my country is very expensive. It costs like 20,000 Kenya shillings. That's about, let's say, about $100, $200, about $100. So about $100, $200. So it's quite expensive, and a patient has to pay for them from their pocket. So we rarely do it in my country, except for private patients. Now, management, again, as I said, management, we leave it to the physicians. But as a surgeon, you need to be aware of how the patient is going to be put on the treatment. And the management really is guided by the WHO guidelines, you know, on the drugs which are used, which I've listed there. So this is how the management proceeds. And usually we put this patient on treatment for minimum 12 months or up to 18 months. But again, as I've said, this is done by a special team, and not only physicians, but we have in our country a special team which handles TB cases. So they're the ones who handle the infectious disease, county infectious disease control units. They're the ones whom handle and they follow up these cases. And the reason, of course, is very clear, because these are drugs which we are not keen that people should play around with them just in case patients develop resistance to these drugs. So that's why they're handled by teams which have been designated that role of doing that. These are the treatment regimens. I think what is important here for is, as I've said, that this is long-term management. And usually we'd be speaking, I know the people talk about 3 months, 6 months, but usually we give about 12 months to 18 months of anti-TB therapy to these patients. I've mentioned about that. Now, the role of corticosteroids. Now, this is one of controversial aspects on the treatment of tuberculosis meningitis, is the use of corticosteroids. The response to steroids may be dramatic, with rapid clearing of sensorium. It was believed that corticosteroids had no place in management of tuberculosis meningitis. Now, I mentioned this here so that you can bear in mind what happens, for example, in this situation where we call paradoxical worsening. Because sometimes you have a patient who has got tuberculosis meningitis, and then after you have managed him with tuberculosis meningitis, you find that he has developed a tuberculoma. And because this is what we call paradoxical worsening. Now, when these patients who are being managed for tuberculosis meningitis, who then incidentally end up now to be found out that they've got tuberculoma, when they're put on steroids, the steroids may suppress those tuberculomas. So, and that one of the reasons I think here in neurosurgery, we have to bear that in mind, that steroids may play a major role in managing these cases. But I mention here this, that this is not tuberculoma management. This is now tuberculosis meningitis management. But now we mention the steroids because a patient with tuberculosis meningitis who has been managed for tuberculosis meningitis with steroids may sometimes tuberculosis meningitis patients end up developing tuberculomas. Maybe it was a solitary lesion, now it flares up. But then because he's on steroids, it may suppress that stage of the illness. Surgery, I've already talked about this, and I've already mentioned about the role of surgery in tuberculomas, especially if there's mass effect. I'd like to dwell on ventriculoperitoneal shunts, patients who have got hydrocephalus and tuberculosis meningitis. Ideally, one may want just to see how best you could contain that hydrocephalus. But if one finds that it's not possible to contain the hydrocephalus, one may opt to insert to place a ventriculoperitoneal shunt. But you have to remember that because of the high protein content of the CSF, then the blockage of this shunt is very common. And this, I think, well, this is one of the reasons why the neurosurgeons really would like to see if that situation can be managed conservatively. And I've talked about that. There's the medical therapy for the shunts, for the hydrocephalus and all that. Okay. And of course, there's that situation where sometimes, theoretically, it's been said that you may disseminate the TB by placing a ventriculoperitoneal shunt. I have never encountered that, and we have placed VP shunts in patients with tuberculosis meningitis who have developed hydrocephalus, but I've never encountered dissemination of the TB intraperitoneally. So, but I have encountered the shunt blocking quite often, and you need then to go back and revise it many times. Indications of surgery, we have talked about that. Okay, and remember, patients who are grade 1 and 2, they do very well. Grade 3, 4, they don't do so well, and you have to make a decision as to whether surgery will be beneficial in those patients or not. If surgery is done early and in the patients, then the outlook is quite good. Like as you have seen, this patient did quite well. We did, but again, as I've said, from the paper which we published, we lost quite a number, about 30% of the patients who were losing who had tuberculosis. But one of the reasons, of course, is that they were presenting late, and patients presenting late is quite common in our situation in our country, and there are a lot of constraints, factors which make our patients come late. Management of intracranial tuberculomas, I've talked about them. I would like here to mention about the role of biopsy for tuberculomas. If, for example, you find that there's really no indication for doing decompressive surgery, then one may opt to do a biopsy of the lesion. But in areas where this situation is endemic, you find that sometimes we are guided by the clinical judgment, and we may not even bother doing the biopsy and just start the patient on anti-TB therapy. So in conclusion, tuberculosis is re-emerging as a major public health problem worldwide. The emergence of multi-drug resistance and the interaction between TB and HIV infection and migration from TB endemic countries to developed countries are responsible for this surge. Emphasis should be placed on effective methods of TB control. In our country, in developing countries, we have very, very effective methods of TB control, and these are taken very seriously. All our children are immunized against TB before the age of 9 months, at around 6 months or 9 months. They're given BCG. But I noticed in developed countries, this is no longer done. But in spite of all this, because of the HIV and all those situations, then we are still having a big, big challenge managing these conditions, and these conditions are going to be with us for some time. I think I've come to the there was this is my declaration, and there are no financial benefits, and patients have given us the consent to discuss this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Nim, for the thorough coverage of TB and the CNS. I wondered if you might comment about using the CSF protein in your algorithm for placing a ventricular peritoneal shunt in cases of TB meningitis. Do you have a certain threshold before which you would use an external ventricular drain? How do you use the CSF protein in those circumstances?
We don't usually use the CSF protein, so we don't routinely do that. Most of
Okay.
the patients, we just manage them.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Do has his hand raised. Alvin, do you have a comment, a question?
Yeah, thank you so much, Professor. I was closely following your presentation, and it is almost like the same thing that we do in Liberia. But the only challenge is for us here regarding the management is that most often there is this misunderstanding between the neurosurgery unit because in Liberia we do not have a neurologist. So there is this misunderstanding between the neurosurgery unit and internal medicine. At times, some of these patients come with suspicion of TB of the spine. All right. And once it is the presumptive diagnosis is made, we usually refer them to internal medicine. And internal medicine, they have a lot of things dealing with. Those patients will be delaying, and when they come back to us, we do the CBC, we do the complete blood count, we do the C-reactive protein, we do baseline investigations to look for signs of infection. But most often, there is a particular unit responsible for the medication, and there, whenever they go there will be a lot of delays. I don't know how is it. How is the delay being worked out at your center, Professor? That's question one. And then, Professor, regarding TB of the spine, I overheard you saying the orthopedic. So, because we have done a couple of cases in Liberia with the help of visiting neurosurgeons, spinal instrumentation surgery with suspected cases of TB. I mean, wherein we fuse. So, what do you think of that? Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And let me answer your last question first. As I said, the TB of the spine The one which we do the surgery is one where the spinal cord is involved and the patient presents with weakness, neurological deficits, and we do an MRI. And nowadays, it's really very, very helpful because with an MRI, we can be able to diagnose tuberculoma very, very confidently. And then we go ahead and do surgery. Now, remember now, with TB of the spine, you can also get the situation you have TB arachnoiditis, where patients almost present almost the same. But now when we do all those investigations, we don't see anything which we can go in and help the patient. So that in that stage, we just have to manage, the physicians manage those patients. Then now we have the TB of the spinal column itself, where now the patient, let's say, presents with pathological fractures or collapses. Now, in those situations, most of the patients who present with TB of the spinal column, we manage conservatively. We don't do surgery in those patients. And the results of conservative management are very good. And there are several reasons why we do that, is because we don't, if we go in, then we can make this TB spread. So usually manage them conservatively with bed rest, etc., and they do quite well. I haven't, and as I've said, because it's not the area I handle all routinely, I don't want to give a very confident reply. But over the past years, I never did instrumentation for TB spine. Over the past years, so. Unless the times have changed now, you get the point. So times may have changed, but in the earlier years, we never used to do instrumentation for TB of the spine, for fear, again, as I said, of causing a spread. And TB is in our country is a very debilitating condition. It kills many patients, and then one has to be very, very cautious so that you don't. You don't subject this patient to deterioration of their clinical condition. So that's the first question. Now the other one which you had asked was, how do we manage the medical the condition, where the patient has got this clinical condition? As I said, in that situation in Kenya is very different because we have a team which handles TB cases. So if in each hospital, you'll have the teaching hospitals, there'll be an expert who is an expert on infectious diseases. Now, usually in the peripheral hospitals, in the smaller hospitals, usually they'll refer to the big centers because this is a national problem. They'll refer the patient to the big centers where the patient is reviewed and then put on treatment and referred back to the small peripheral hospitals. And because we have quite a number of physicians, we haven't had that problem at all. And as I said, the role which as neurosurgeons we play in management of these conditions is really on the complications. You know, we don't play any role in managing the TB itself, you know, and I think for that reason, it's why we don't face the frustrations which you are facing. I hope I've answered your question.
I think there Ali and Professor Kaba have a question.
Yes, sir, if you don't mind. Thank you very much for such a nice review. The type of the miliary TB which happens is the small cell seeding on the body, especially on the brain, it affects the sixth cranial nerve. It's one of the things typical which happens with the miliary TB. The other point is that there is a test named acid fast staining that we used to do on the sputum of the suspicious patient and the CSF. So that's another old technique, which is not 100%, but it's very effective in making the diagnosis of the tuberculosis. Thank you very much. Great review, sir.
Thank you. We still do sputum analysis in my country. And it's also almost routine. But again, as I said, it's not us who do it. It's done by the physicians. Thank you.
Professor Kaba.
Yeah, more than a question is a contribution. My point here is for 25 years, I have never had the opportunity to operate on any tuberculoma in the brain here in Ghana. But yes, I performed a lot on pod disease. And in fact, I started operating on pod disease in Ghana. And I'm happy to inform, to side with Professor, that at the beginning, in the last 10 to 15 years, the first 10 to 15 years, we never had to put instrumentation in pod disease. And they do well. And most of them were thoracic. And most of them, we did the transthoracic approach and lateral approach to the thoracic region. However, recently, I don't know, for some reason, I'm yet to find out why we decided that. Because of the level of destruction of the vertebral bodies, we have decided to put screws on a couple of them. Of course, first, we're treating the TB, we're using the protocol, and then before we do the surgeries. But I'm still wondering if it is at the thoracic level, whether we should put screws or not. Thoracic level, I hardly do that. But lumbar level, yes, I do think that they will benefit, because the thoracic level, you got the cage, and the thoracic cage, and it can help. But lumbar level, I think that probably that's where we put the screws to benefit. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I think as I said, because I don't handle these cases, so the answer which I'll give you will not be an absolute answer. The TB is handled by the orthopedic surgeons, and I don't know whether now they're doing instrumentation or not. I really will have to get it. I'll discuss it with them. I get a feedback from them. But we are called to do the surgery for spinal TB, and we do maybe, I remember, maybe we do about 3 or 4 cases. But remember, where I was working previously was a major referral hospital, so we'll be getting cases from all over the country.
Alvin, did you want to make some comments?
Professor, I'll wait for the professor. Professor Samuel, I think he wants to talk. I'll wait.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to commend him for an excellent lecture. Our experience here is quite similar in a way. We see a lot of STB problem in Nigeria, but the ones that reach neurosurgical service are mostly spine. Occasionally, very occasionally, we see tuberculomas in the brain. We have been cut out once, in fact, where the diagnosis wasn't suspected. And then surgery was done while waiting for the histology report. The patient developed meningitis, tuberculosis meningitis. And unfortunately, despite intervention with drugs, we didn't save the life of the patient. That was a lesson, that once we suspect, we will even commence anti-tuberculosis treatment while waiting for the histology confirmation. Now, gene expert, of course, has come here to help, hasten the diagnosis. Also, we have had occasions where Bellows concentric sclerosis, which is a variant of multiple sclerosis, had been mistaken for a TB or tuberculoma of the brain. It was only histology that eventually led to correct diagnosis. So we have to be aware of that. There are other differential diagnoses for TB brain. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem, or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit and to help us improve our programming. The recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions, comments, requests for CME credit to osman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. and the foundation which sponsors this program, sponsors and owns Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, with Nancy Epstein as its editor-in-chief, and also sponsors SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, a 3D video journal, interactive with discussion. Its web address is snidigital.org. Both of these journals are free 24/7, 365, to everyone, everywhere. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories, has the third largest readership in the world since 2010. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is viewed in 107 countries in 5 months and is the first video journal of neurosurgery. The foundation is dedicated to helping people throughout the world. In addition, the foundation sponsors the Medical News Network to bring truthful medical and science news to the world. This information is copyrighted in 2024 by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, which is an IRS USA 501c3 operating charitable foundation. All rights are reserved. Thank you very much for watching this program.